and ask, well, don't you remember my name? Because I already told you. Okay. So my name is Michael Terry, and you are?
George.
Dr. Maxwell.
All right. Let's try a little more effort here, Okay. My name is Michael Terry, and you are?
George.
All right, cool. So I'm a professor of computer science in the David R. Sheraton School of Computer Science at the University of Waterloo, Ontario, Canada. That is a mouthful. David R. Sheraton just gave us about $25 million, so you give $25 million to a school, you get your name on the school plaque. My specialty is human-computer interaction research, so I study people, how they use systems, and how we can make systems easier to use, more usable, and more useful. And in the past, I've been this lurking past contributor to the GIMP, very, very small contributions, so I'm embarrassed to say one of the first ScriptFu tutorials was mine, Mike Terry's Black Belt School of ScriptFu, written at a time about 10 years ago when I didn't really know Scheme, and it really shows in the tutorial. And I also wrote JGIMP, which is the Java language binding for the GIMP for the 1L series. Okay. What I do primarily is I study artists and designers, in situ observations, interviews, and the like, to understand how to make the tools better for them. I use mixed methods, which means I employ techniques that anthropologists use, so techniques inspired by ethnographic methods. Again, in situ observations, things like think alouds, so you sit someone down and you ask them to think aloud as they use an application. And then I use those findings to drive the design of new research tools, or new tools in the research domain. So I'll give you a quick demo of stuff I've done in the past. This is about 5 years old now, but it gives you a sense of the type of work that I have done. So suppose we're designing the logo for a jelly festival, okay? So we know that grape jelly is really popular, and so we first start out with this Jelly Fest logo right here, but we want to explore. We know that there are other types of jelly. There are mint jellies, there are strawberry jellies, so we want to explore other alternatives. So let's bring up hue, saturation, lightness. Let's modify the hue. This would be a good one for strawberry jelly. And this monitor resolution is so low that I can actually go and hit OK. Get rid of this. Okay, there we go. So now we have a red version, but that means we lost the purple version. So if we wanted to go back to our grape and preserve both of these, we'd have to do something like undo, duplicate the document, bring back the filter, modify the filter, and then hit apply and then close. Okay. All right, and so I saw experienced Photoshop users repeatedly play with the sliders as they were working on documents and thought, well, you know, couldn't there be a better way? So I came up with this version of previews called side views, where you see multiple simultaneous sets of previews. So every parameter has a set of previews, so you get a sense of the range of possibilities afforded to you. So if you want a red, you can click on the red, and you can see it starts to narrow in on shades of red there. Okay? So you see, you have a better sense of the overall space of possibilities, and then when you're ready, you can apply it and then hit close. Okay? This becomes especially useful when you have things that are difficult to predict, like whirl and pinch. So as I make modifications to one, then you see how it affects the other parameters right there. So you get a broader overview of the space of possibilities. Okay. So this is one way to support designers as they're working with these tools. But the other thing that I wanted to support was exploration without commitment. So say we want to have these different colored versions. Well, rather than hit OK or have to go back and duplicate, you can hit create new versions, which will duplicate the document, insert a new visual version into the document, and then provide a visualization tool to switch between them. Okay. So now let's add purple version as well. Now we have three alternatives within the same document space. You can switch between them, visualize them, turn them on and off. And then if I want to add a little bit more of a punch to the document, let's add a little bit of whirl and pinch, we can apply a command to all of them at the same time. Okay. So this is, again, this is old research, it's about 5 years old. This is a flavor of the kind of stuff I've done in the past. This is behind me, and what I want to do now is talk about where the research we're doing with in GIMP and better characterize how people are using the software in the wild. Before I leave this, are there any questions we can answer about this stuff? Sure. No. If you went into, because this was my dissertation work and it was more important for me to finish my dissertation than putting a closed source project. Good question. Yes?
What about performance considerations? Are you not securing all the previous being expensive?
What about performance issues? So we can just sort of point to Moore's law. Actually, a lot of this stuff, it depends on the type of filter. Okay, so for some filters, these things are real time. Others are more computationally expensive. So there's a question of the trade-off that we haven't looked into in terms of, you know, at what point does calculating these things take too much time when it becomes less interactive? I don't have a good answer for that question yet. Yes?
Is this transformation function there working on the bitmap data or on the vector data of the fonts?
This is all working on bitmap data. All right, so I want to move on now to the primary part of this talk. So, my current research, I'm asked the question of, right now what I'm asking is the question, how can open source do usability in ways that commercial software companies can't? Okay, I want you to notice the tone of that question. It's not, how can we play catch up? It's what are the unique affordances of the open source community that may lend themselves to techniques that commercial companies can't do because they're closed source. So the unique advantages, how can we make use of this community and its properties to create highly useful, usable, and enjoyable software? Okay, I'm particularly interested in long-term sustainable usability infrastructures. Right, so we want to create infrastructures where it doesn't place an undue burden on the developers or the end users. Right, so it's pretty easy to come up with new ways of doing usability or applying existing usability techniques from the commercial software companies or commercial software world to open source. But we always have to take into consideration that a lot of the development is done by volunteers in their spare time, and so what we don't want to do is create new burdens on them. Okay? So I want you to keep these points in mind as I go through my talk today. Okay? So, who is your average GIMP user, or who is using the GIMP? What are the range of users? What are they using it for? What size images do they work on? How many layers do they use? Which tools do they use most frequently? Okay. Does anyone have definitive answers to any of these questions? Okay. These are really hard questions to answer. You can pull people into usability labs, you can sit them down, you can do think lab protocols with them, and you can get a wealth of information, very good qualitative information about what is good and what's bad about a particular interface. But it's very difficult to characterize the use of these projects in the wild. So who is your average user, or what are the sets of average users? Okay. So to answer the question, you mentioned you can employ qualitative methods, things like think alouds, observations, interviews. You can also do quantitative things like questionnaires. But there's not really a good infrastructure in place right now in the open source community to support these. It's growing, it's on the rise, but in terms of quantitative, there's not a good infrastructure in place. It's important to realize that none of these methods are the be-all, end-all. They really are complementary methods, right? So characterizing use or usability, you can approach it both from the qualitative and quantitative sides. More rare are long-term studies of software in the wild, right? So how do people use this software over time? So how does the entire community use the software over time? Do they use it just a few times a week? Do they use it hours on end every day? These questions are very difficult to answer right now. So what if we had a mirror? Okay, so bear with me for a second here. What if we had a mirror that we could actually hold up to reflect back onto the community how the software is being used in practice? Okay? So, let's actually do a demo. All right. I'm going to start up the GIMP. Make a new document. Yeah. Add some text. And I'm going to reduce that font size just a bit. And let's move it around a bit. And let's just paint a circle around it. And let's save that. And close it. Okay, so except for a few extra splash screens, that would look like a pretty normal version of the game. Now, if we go over to the InGigs website, we go to the logs session section. And we go to today. You notice now that there's a log entry right here, session tag LGM 2007, and we have a complete record of that entire session right there. Okay, so a lot of app window events, and you can see right here, we created the image. We applied the text tool. Lots of app window and document window events. Added a layer, used the paintbrush, and then down towards the bottom, we saved it, and we disposed of the image, we closed the image. So I used the game right there, just as I normally would. In the background, it recorded exactly what I was doing. It saved the file, transmitted it to the InGIMP website, where it is now publicly available for anyone to look at and analyze. Okay? We have timings to the microsecond level, though it's questionable how close to the microsecond level that actually is. Here is a unique identifier for myself. Here's the platform. Here's my time zone right here. Here's the tags I inserted at the beginning of that. Entry numbers, timing, time snaps, events, and over here on the right, when we open, close, save an image, we actually take histograms of the image. Okay. All right. So that is all well and good. But it's pretty boring on itself, right? It would be, as an end user, that doesn't really compel me to want to use this for the sake of, you know, providing data out of the goodness of my own heart, okay? That's why you can go over to, let me start it up actually. Bring it down. Entirely too much software installed. When you start up in GIMP, you have the option of launching the GIMP right there, or you can click this button right here, Website and Stats, which will take me to a customized view of my statistics that have been collected by InGIMP. And I'm going to bring up a precached page, and I'll talk about why I'm bringing up a precached page a little bit later. There we go. So this right here, when it actually finally loads, this is what the page looks like. This is my mirror of how I'm actually using the software. The images right here, I have to apologize, are static. I'm trying to get the talk in the final version of this software ready for release. We weren't able to get these, the code in place to dynamically compose these. But this right here is my InGIMP persona. This reflects how I use the software. Okay? These will be dynamically constructed right now. Again, this is just a static composition, but we have, in the right hand, the tools that I use most often. In my left hand, a canvas that represents the type of images I work on. So this right here is a painter's canvas. We have canvases for graphic artists and for photographic manipulation. And then it's also sized according to the size of the images that I work on. There's a tie around my neck indicating that I mostly use the GIMP during business hours during the weekday. Okay. So we can dynamically create these to reflect how it's being used. So this is your persona. This is one of the motivations we have for offering InGIMP, or for you to actually download and use InGIMP. Now, the great thing about these personas is that we can take a group shot of the in-game community, right? So we can create an avatar or a persona for every person and then compose it there so you can have your mirror onto the community. You can see how it's being used, okay? So these are not your typical data summaries or visualizations. They are driven by the data, but they're represented in a very personable way, okay? But we also have stats, all right? So we've been using this internally for about a month now, so these stats just reflect our own usage. We've had 9 installations, 244 logs uploaded, representing 4 days, 8 hours of in-game being open, and 13,000 commands applied. We have 23 log sessions on average per user. My use, I have 76 log sessions. Average session length is about a half an hour for the community and for myself. Average number of commands by the community, 80 or 79, and then I have about 16. That's because I just started out to do a quick test and check the log file, so not a lot of in-depth use. And then we have also the monitor height and width, typical for the community and then for myself. And you can see right here, my laptop's resolution 1900 is really sort of skewing the average right there, so nice people using it. We have the most frequently used commands, the community, 2,000 uses of the pencil. That's because the fellow developing the personas, in-game personas, has been doing it in the game. And so he is really weighting the most frequently used commands. But you can see right there, about half of that, you have undo and then also save frequently used, right? Side by side, my use, okay? So we have the ability to collect the data, but then we personalize it, right? You see how you compare it to the rest of the community so that there's this element of participation, okay? And let's see, that's that, and then there's a link to the logs, where you can look at the raw log files and then the process log files, the version I showed you right there where you had it in columns, that's the process version. Okay? Questions on this before I return to my talk? All right. So, personas, I mentioned that we can dynamically compose them. Here are a couple more versions. So right here we have one for people doing graphic design with different tools, so pencil, crop, text, paint bucket. Right here we have a littering of images that were cut out indicating that the person is doing a composition of images from several different images. And then a band-aid on the forehead, and this represents people who make mistakes a lot in the interface, so it sort of connotes them banging their head against the interface. Here's another version.
How do you measure how many, are you measuring those states by the amount of views undo?
No. So right now the primary method that we're measuring mistakes is just, it's one particular feature right now. We want to add more. But this grew out of our own observations. So we saw a lot of instances of people duplicating an image and then closing it right after it was duplicated. Okay. Why? For people who haven't talked to me yesterday.
I don't remember the interface, but I imagine duplicate
menu items
right next to a
common. So, he suggests it might be close to another commonly used item. Actually, Control D is duplicate in GIMP. It is deselect in Photoshop. So if you're a Photoshop user and you sit down and use the GIMP, you're gonna hit Control D to get rid of the selections, you're actually duplicate the document and close it. So this is one of the measures that we're using right now for mistakes. If you use the QWERTY layout, yes.
Yeah.
And if you use Dvorak, no.
But the vast majority of users use that layout, so I think the person who uses the S and
D. Good point, and that would be a good thing to log, whether we had the Dvorak or QWERTY layout. So this is one of the dangers of doing this, because we'll sit down and do observations of people and we'll say, hey, we should log this, we should log that, and there's just this never-ending list of things that we want to, data that we want to collect. And so there are actual discussion forums we have set up to be able to host this kind of discussion of what data we should be getting. So another example of an avatar here, right? We have a canvas with different pieces stuck on it to indicate that users are composing images from pieces of multiple images. The glasses right there, they look 3D right there. We're actually going to change both lenses to red. They are to connote rose-colored glasses to indicate you're doing things like manipulating the colors of the image, like color balance, levels, and that kind of stuff. Okay? Oh, and this right here. So this is a remote control. We had a hard time figuring out how we were going to represent filters in the tool hand, and so we thought, okay, what do filters have? Well, they typically have knobs and levers and that kind of stuff. Well, we'll just make a remote control. So if you have better ideas, let us know, but it's a cute little remote. Okay, so another version, final version of the avatar. Right here we have wallet size snapshots to indicate you're working on smaller images, a camera around the neck to indicate that you're doing mostly photographic tasks, or images related, or tasks related to photographic images. Okay, so I gave you the demo. Let me formally introduce you to NGIMP, talk briefly about the architecture, the type of data we collect, how we make sense of that data, privacy considerations, and then I'll conclude my talk. All in 15 minutes. So what is NGIMP? So NGIMP is an instrumented version of GIMP. It's meant to allow us to peer into the community's use of the GIMP. It's a usability tool for the curious and for the usability experts alike. So you saw that we've taken a lot of effort to try to make this compelling to your average end user and not just someone who likes to twiddle bits. Okay? And it can be used as a snap-in replacement for the GIMP. Okay? In terms of the architecture, there are a few hooks into the core of GIMP. So hooks into event streams so we can know when an image is open, saved, and closed. Hooks into dialog boxes so that we know when dialog boxes appear or moved, when windows are resized, and so on. Surrounding the GIMP, there is a Python-based wrapper. When you see the splash screen, that's in Python. It takes care of setting the environment to log the information, user events, and then it takes care of actually transmitting that file to the web server. So the data we collect. So there are four primary types of data we collect: commands, interface events, document characteristics, and then system characteristics. Okay, so we log what commands are used when, we log their names, but we don't record the parameters. Okay, so we don't record any parameters for the command. So for example, if you use the text tool, we don't record what text you actually input. Okay? We also record the document that's affected by that particular command. We log things like tool selection, so when you change switch between the different tools in the tool palette, we log when colors are changed, when the images are zoomed in and out, and so on. The changes to colors, things like this, you can consider the actual color chosen to be a parameter, and so we don't log that. So there's no risk of us figuring out your favorite color palette by using NGIMP. We log basic interface events, so window resize events, move, minimize, maximize, re-log key events, when keys are released, but not the actual keys that are pressed. Okay, we log the modifier keys, but not the actual key. And I'll show you a snippet of the log files where you can verify this. We record the mouse events, so when buttons are clicked, we record what button, but we don't record where for the same reason. So what is the danger of recording mouse location? Right, so you could redo the paint action. If you sat there and signed your name in the game, then we'd be able to recover that. So we don't record any of the pointer locations. And we record when menus are accessed. Okay. We record in terms of the document. So this is fairly unique to this project. I'm not aware of any other logging system that does this. We record characteristics of the document itself. So the size of the image, the number of layers, layer characteristics, whether the layers are visible, and we record histograms of the image. Okay, and you'll see a bit later how this can be useful. All right, so that the histograms provide us a general overview of the types of images that people are working on without actually having to ask them to specify the type of image or to actually transmit that image. We record basic system characteristics, so the operating system that's used, the number of monitors that the user has, the resolutions of the monitors, and then their time zone. So we can figure out where in the world people are using this. Okay, So I've talked about the in-game, the architecture, the type of data we collect. Now I want to turn to this huge problem of making sense of this data. Okay, so in-game can generate huge log files. So the artist working on our personas, he will generate about a 50 meg XML file after 5 hours of use. Right? So just gobs and gobs of data. Imagine if we have hundreds or thousands of people working on this, there's lots and lots of this data. So you're not going to be sifting through this manually. You want to be able to automatically go through it and make sense of that data. So how do we do that? Well, there are three different techniques that we're using right now. One is we do observational studies of people to associate behavior, high-level behavior with low-level log actions. We have tags at startup, and we also have this concept called a reality check. Okay, so we bring people in, we ask them to do a particular task like design a logo, and to think aloud as they're working on the software. Their actions then we can start to correlate with the log data, and this is one of the best ways to figure out what questions we should be asking and then how we should be analyzing the data. So let me give you some examples. So I already mentioned the duplicate close sequences, which indicate that we have a Photoshop user on our hands. There's also things like try undo cycles, where you'll see someone apply a command and then undo it and then apply the same command, and they'll do this several times. And generally what we find is that this is an indication of insufficient preview on the part of the command that's being used. Okay? So that's a particular pattern that we can pull out to figure out, okay, what commands seem to have inadequate previews where the user can't compose the result that they want the first time around. Okay? Layer duplication. So you see people use layers to hold alternatives. Right? So this is one of the motivations for things like the group layers that was discussed yesterday. Right? There, for the types of problems that artists and designers solve, there's no one right way to solve it, and they often have to generate sets of alternatives to be able to compare and contrast them. One way that they manage that set of alternatives is to hold the different contents in, or the different alternatives in layers. We see undo-redo cycles. So undo-redo cycles are when an action is applied and it's repeatedly undone and redone. Does anyone know the motivation for this? Right, exactly. It's used as an evaluation technique. Right, so the two different versions are flashed on the screen repeatedly so that you can assess whether or not you like the particular change and whether it gets you to your end goal faster. Okay? And you see people do this to the point where they can't remember which is the newer version, and then they just stop at the one that they like. This really works. So when you look at people doing this, this really works in Photoshop because Control-Z is mapped to undo and redo repeatedly. You see slow, fast menu usage. So there are some people at Carnegie Mellon, Amy Hirst, Scott Hudson, and Jen Mankoff who have just come up with a machine learning classifier to be able to classify people as novices or experts based on how quickly they use the menus. Okay, so this is something that we want to grab and snap into our system. And then image histograms. So if I show these two image histograms, what can you tell me about these two images at a very high level? What's that? Exactly. So we have very distinct signatures for two different types of images, so we can get a sense of the type of images people are working on. So things like line art are on top, whereas we have photographic images where we have a lot more variance in the histograms that are being generated for the images. Okay. Tags, so when you start up, you can specify what it is that you want to be doing, and this is just a way for us to be able to understand the types of tasks that people are performing in their own words. And we structure this by saying, I will be doing X, right? So we're trying to at least normalize to some extent, to the extent possible, the types of descriptions that people use by having them fill in the blank. I will be doing blank, image correction, graphic design, mashups, whatever. In the future, we will enable the use of tags to filter on the data on our website. Right? So if you have, say, a group of people and you want to just filter the data based on the group, you can use a common tag between them and then filter that on the website. So, reality checks. So, there's a whole continuum of data collection methods. So we have On the one end, things like qualitative methods where we do interviews and observations. On the other end, quantitative methods, like, for example, where you bring people into a laboratory and ask them to perform a very specific task. We want to add to the range of, range of techniques by introducing this concept of reality check, where we can give people very focused tasks to perform in the wild. Okay? So we have on the website a section for reality checks. Let's see if I can find it in my browser. Okay. We have reality checks online where we ask you to perform a very particular task. Okay, so right here we want to improve the tonal range of an image. We give you the URL for that task, and in the GIMP, you can use the open location command to load that URL. Okay? Now, if you're a Windows user, you know, perhaps, that open location right here, where you can give your URL, does not work. In NGIMP, it does. Okay, so we have a Python helper application which will actually allow you to load up a URL given. So we have right here, for example, this URL. We'll copy the link location over here and open it. Man, we got a lot of nice shots of that black console screen. And I'm not sure. What's that? Oh, I better be. So as the file loads, let me just talk about what's going on there. When we get that location in the GIMP, we check it to see if it's coming from our website. If it's coming from our website, if that URL is from the reality check section, we insert that URL into the log file. So when we get the log files back, we can figure out which of the tasks right there are associated with that particular reality check. Okay? So if we ask you to color correct an image, we give you the URL, you load up that URL, that URL is injected into the log file, and then we can follow that log file to figure out or to associate it with that particular task to see how people perform that task in the wild. Right? So if you have a question of how do people do X, we can create a reality check with a set of instructions, the image to load up, and then as the data comes in, we can get some better answers about how people do X when they're not in a usability lab. Okay, so analyzing the data, I mentioned we have gobs of data. XML files can be huge, so working for about 5 hours, an artist would generate log files of about 25,000 different log entries. It's a lot of data. Right now, we're working on the analysis tool on the server side, even just with our own testing. We're running into interesting problems, as they say, of how to efficiently answer questions. We want to have the analysis being driven in real time. We're there for some aspects, where they're not there for other aspects of analyzing the data. Okay, so let me talk a bit about privacy. All the data that we collect is made available publicly on the website. This is not your usual usability lab setup. Typically, when you do a usability test, you are guaranteed confidentiality. You have some assurances that your data is not going to be leaked into the world without your permission. We're sort of throwing those notions out the window, and we're trying to collect information from people as they use it in the privacy of their own home, the comfort of their own home. So obviously, there are privacy issues that you want to be aware of. So in the design of this, we really have to weigh programmer convenience with user awareness, right? And here, user awareness really has to trump any sort of programmer convenience. We have to design this in a way where we have transparent data collection process so people can be assured that we're not doing anything bad. Okay? So let me talk to you a bit about the ways that we address this issue. So when you start up, you can disable logging for this particular run just by checking this box. It's not sticky, so that every time you start up, you have to check this. We only collect application usage information. As I mentioned, key and mouse activity is collected, but we don't collect keystrokes, nor the location of where the mouse is being used. Okay. We write out to a human-readable XML file format. So I mentioned I would show keystroke logging. This is the six Yes, six events that represent main typing in GIMP into the GIMP text editor. You can see we have the entry numbers, so 581, 583, and so on. We have the date, we have the elapsed time since startup. We have the event right there. It's happening in the GIMP text editor window. There's information about the lunar roll. We have the event type and then the modifier state. And you can see the event type and modifier state are the same all the way down. So no keys are being drawn. Okay. Finally, you can inspect the source. Right? You can look at exactly what we're doing. We have a patch available. It's on the web, so you can just focus on the differences. And I just ask you, you know, so try that, you know, with your favorite open or favorite closed source or software that automatically phones home to central headquarters, sitting heaven knows what. Okay, Microsoft Office is instrumented to send information back to headquarters. You have to opt in, but once you do that, you really have no idea of what data is being transmitted. They don't make it publicly available. With open source, we have the luxury of being very assured about the type of information that's being collected. Okay, so there are a couple privacy issues that we are aware of. We are very explicit about this on our website and set an agreement that you see when you start the application. The two things that we currently aware of are tags and custom script names. So you can enter any text you want into the tags field at startup. So obviously, you know, if you type something like I'm going to be photo manipulating Aunt Edna's picture, well, that's going to be available on the web. If you have custom scripts that you've written, those names are injected into the log file, and you use them because we log every single command. But other than that, these are the only known privacy issues that we have. Okay, so I mentioned compelling use. So, and I showed the in-game personas. So there's always this problem of self-selection when you do usability studies. You know, people have to volunteer to participate. We're trying to address the issue of self-selection by making it compelling to the average end user by having personalized statistics to satisfy things like innate curiosity. We have a single Windows installer that throws everything onto the disk that you need, so you don't have to have separate installers for the game from GTK. There's Unix source in the patch. And then we have, again, the stick figures, which represent basic information visualization. We have staging areas to communicate use, so tool use in the right hand, canvas use in the left hand. We chose to go with these stick figures so that other projects could use them as well. Right? We wanted to have a representation of users that was easy enough for anyone to sit down and draw. And so our examples right now give you an indication of how this might be applied to other projects as well. And then they lend themselves to the community snapshot. So let me just quickly go through these. This is an old version that we had. We originally had a typewriter represent text, but it was a little bit too big. And then we had hat for people who are Photoshop users who sit down and use the GIMP. But when we saw this, we thought, hey, you know, we could actually have hats for different projects. So if another open source project wanted to pick up the concept of avatars, they could sort of modify the hat logo to represent their own particular project. Okay, and there's a larger shot of the community picture. So I'm going to finish up with some project status. So we have Windows and Unix clients ready for download. This is the public introduction to GIMP. So if you've never heard about it before, this is why, because it's the first time that we're actually publicly announcing it. We're gradually filling out the server side with analyses and classification schemes. Most importantly, you want to know what you want to know. So you can email us, you can go to the forum and say, you know, we'd be interested to learn this particular aspect about how the GIMP is used. All right, so I'm going to skip the conclusions right there and go right to the credits. Matthew Kay designed the in-game avatars for personas, actually what we call them now. Brian Van Buck constructed the code to actually dynamically compose them. Jaime Riz did the website. Tom Ayer did the forums and came up with some official reality checks. I'd like to thank the GIMP community for making a fabulous piece of software. It enabled this project, but also my PhD dissertation some years ago. I'd like to thank the event organizers and corporate sponsors for a great event. And also mention this work is partially supported by a grant from NSERC. So these are the links and URLs, and I will take questions before we head out to lunch. Yes?
You mentioned integrating other applications.
So, the question is, how hard would it be to integrate with other applications?
Say, with a non-duplicate application.
Right. So, right now, what we're most focused on are questions like, you know, what type of data is going to be most useful, what type of analyses are going to be most useful. After we get a sense of this, then we want to go back and reconsider, you know, how can we normalize or systematize the process of collecting the data and putting it to a web server. Okay. So how hard is it to collect? Well, it's not too hard to throw some hooks in there and then write that out to a file. It would be much easier if you had an API or your library to assist you. In the long term, we'd like to have that so that you can take care of, you know, you don't have to worry about a lot of these issues. Right, so there are plenty of little plumbing issues that you have to be concerned about with the logging. For example, we just dump the data onto a web server and then eventually it's publicly available. You want to make sure that you're getting real data and not someone's wares. Right, so you have to have a backend that helps verify that you're getting actual log content. So there are a lot of little nuggets like that that one has to be aware of. Hopefully in the long term you will have something that becomes a bit more systematic. Yes?
Inkscape already has a logging facility where if you set a certain environment variables, you get an XML log of the events during the session. Right now that's mostly internal stuff, but it would be pretty trivial to add another event class and instrument UI events. So at that, you know, assuming we put that in, that'll probably be a couple days of work.
Oh, right, a couple days of work and then it gets going on Inkscape.
Yeah.
So
I guess really the only other piece is the Python front end which sets up the environment to do the work.
Right. Right, so definitely, I mean, there's the source code is available. You can look at the front end, you can look at the wrapper and figure out how to integrate that. The one thing, so I mean, if you want to go and play with this, the one thing that I'm very curious about is just adoption and perception of the software, because this is, you know, this is pretty novel where we're collecting information that's transmitted to a web server and made publicly available. And so, you know, if we get scorched, I'd rather us get scorched before other projects start to get scorched by, you know, this issue of the data collection. But I mean, that would be fantastic if it was just that easy, you know, once we sort of figure out this is the rhythm, this is what should be done, if, you know, we could then spread to other projects and see how we can collect the data and reflect it back in the community. Yes?
You're kind of shipping this as like a separate tool, like it's an NPM versus NPM.
Yes.
And why did you choose to go that route and not going the route where there's like a GIMP conference and try to get in the mainstream GIMP so I can have any version of GIMP and say,
right, so the question is why didn't we try to go, you know, mainstream this and throw it into the regular distribution? Okay. And again, the question really, it goes back to this notion of how people are going to perceive this idea of collecting data, right? So this is, again, a very sensitive issue to some people where, you know, they could really get worked up about the fact that the application is logging information. So before we even want to suggest this to be part of a mainstream distribution, we want to work out these issues with a version of the GIMP that's very clearly different and clearly indicates how it is different from the main version.
A comment on popularity. Debian has a popularity that a lot of people
subscribe
to. Right.
Right. So there's the popularity the popularity tool for Debian. Again, I would argue that one of the things that is unique about this is it's tracking how you're actually using the software on a day-to-day basis, which some people might perceive to be a bit more sensitive than what application they might install. Yes?
Yeah, so I have a comment and question. So in the web world, many people are using audience browser like LastFM.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems that the issue of privacy, if you put it out front and say, contributing to this community, it seems to be beyond. So I'm curious if you thought about how this could affect my social networking.
Yeah.
So like how you could, let's say for example, it's the editor in this case. So you could then take your usability data and ship it over to our libraries.
Yep.
And add that to your profile.
Yep.
Have you thought about that or?
Yeah, absolutely. So I mean, so the question is, you know, how could we use this data beyond usability? You know, how could we use it for things like social networking? Or how could we use this to support people in learning how to perform other tasks? So certainly there are a lot of different uses of the data. We're going to be focusing on how we can create this nice, crisp summary of the application use in the community. in the longer term, or if other people want to look at it, you know, there is the possibility of doing things like figuring out a particular style of work that a person has and then sharing this with people who might benefit from it. Right, so I think there are opportunities to start to connect people based on an understanding of how the software is being used. But we haven't fully explored that yet. It's a really interesting idea. Yes?
I'd like to know, do you already have usage data from a significant number of users? And did you already draw some conclusions for that? I'm curious about that.
Right, so significant, we have 9 installations and about 5 of us who have been using this for about a month. I think in terms of the data, do I have any really great nuggets? Not yet. I mean, the most interesting information is just, you know, how we've been able to start to pick out users based on things like, you know, duplicate clothes, right, or be able to classify them. So I wouldn't be able to, I wouldn't suggest that we have any sort of anything really significant with why people are using it right now. I think the more interesting tidbits are going to happen when we, you know, have, you know, dozens, hundreds, or however many users, and then we can start to clump them into classes of users and really get a picture of the community in general. Yes? So am I concerned about people sending in fake data? No. I'm not really. I mean, you know, why? You know, what would the motivation be? So if they think there's a feature that's needed. What's that? Yes, like voting fraud. I'll deal with that problem when it arises. I'm not too concerned about it. I think that we would probably be able to pick that data out quickly, but, you know, because there will be certain characteristics of it. You know, when you have a 5-hour log file, it's pretty heavy duty, and, you know, it's hard to fake that. I mean, you can sit down manually and do it, you could, or you could write a script to do it, but, I mean, you could also just get on the forums and complain, so.
I was bothered by the expert being a measurement of the speed to menu, which it's true, more familiar with the menus. But it seems like the more I get to know the app, the more I don't know what I want to do with the next thing. You know?
Right. Okay, so the question or observation is that, you know, looking at menu usage is a fairly coarse classification of novice versus expert, right?
Yes.
And in fact, you can talk about novices and experts in a lot of different ways. You might be an expert with image manipulation techniques in general, but new to the game. So you're an expert in one domain and novice
right.
in another.
So I'm just, like, it's an interesting data to gather, but I'm just wondering if maybe it could be called something different.
Right, so.
But even then,
Right, so this raises a really big issue with respect to the transparency of the data analysis technique. So we've just started to consider how we're going to frame the presentation of the statistics to be very clear what they are. So when we start to get very high-level interpretations, you want to know, okay, what reasoning went into this particular classification. And I agree that if we just said, okay, you're a novice because you're really slow with the menus, then we might be, you know, classifying people who might have disabilities, for example, as novices when they're actually experts in the application.
That might be me too.
Right, so at the very least, what we can say is, you know, this percentage of the population, as, you know, many times that, you know, seem to suggest they're novices, this percentage doesn't. Okay, so we can, the way we frame it is going to be critical, and, you know, I'll be very open and receptive to feedback about how we can, you know, present the data so we don't have these mischaracterizations coming up in the larger community.
I could write a script that could beat me. And it would be stupid. Mm-hmm. But it would be expert.
Right. Yep.
According to me, so.
Yeah, this sort of question might be similar to what I've done in other fields. There were a number of people who instrumented web browsers. One of the things that came out of that was over time, the usage of web browsers changed.
Right.
So early on, the back button was super most common user feature in the web browser. Because people would go somewhere and say, oh, I want to go here and get back. The assumption was the interpretation research. Over time, people started to scroll up. Scroll down beyond the first paper. It was very interesting that it actually took several years before scrolling down was anything like as common as it could pass.
Right.
And I'd be very interested. I will be very interested if you do this every several years. And also if you have a way of asking how long people have been using the application.
Right. Right. So I mentioned that longitudinal studies are rare software.
Yes.
They're very costly. So it would be interesting to see how this data grows over time or how people's usage change over time. We bring up another interesting point. If this continues to be a part of the distribution and or if we continue to maintain this as upgrades or updates occur to the GIMP, it would be interesting to use this to track how new features are adopted over time. Yes?
The patch for the Unix version against which upstream version of GIMP is it?
2.2.13.
Are there plans to update it so it could be merged to current versions of GIMP?
So we would love to. Right now, this is that our focus is going to be on the server side and coming at, and working on the analyses. Yes. Opportunity to customize them more, how can we show things that developments over time and so on. So we have thought about, you know, if you had a t-shirt, could you upload an icon and put on the t-shirt? Are there other ways that we could modify the avatars to show a greater range of tasks? We'd be interested in these ideas. One of the things that we would like to do is create snapshots of your usage over time so you can have portraits on a wall of who you are as a in-GIMP user over time, right? So if you started out as a novice, then you could have this picture, sort of like, you know, the marks that you have on the wall when you're growing up. Did that answer your question? Okay. Okay, so how representative is a person and is misrepresentative? Is that sort of...
My lector, they all hold this very specific. Maybe we could set the tag, so we can debase the test. And then make the text version, looking at the voice.
So I mean, this is an open question of you know, how people are going to perceive these avatars, how they might want to game them. Gaming them might be hard. We don't know. I mean, this is sort of, you know, the first pass of the system rights research. This is, you know, we're very receptive to conversations about this, dialogues about this. We have forums set up, linked off the websites to hold these conversations. So I'd love to talk more about this offline. And I'm way over time, and we have lunch, and so, I mean, don't feel bad if you want to go to lunch. I don't know where or when to end it, because there's one more question. Do you want to ask it, or do you want to wait till lunch?
I don't need lunch, but... I was wondering how you judge the inclusiveness of the patch itself. I'm fascinated by this. I'm wondering about how we as GIMP developers help you well, I guess you're right about the concerns regarding privacy and not taking the streamlined GIMP installation with some kind of data log facilities, but I think there's nothing that competes against adding something to our infrastructure, helping your helping keep your cache small.
Yeah. Basically. So yeah, we can talk about this offline. I mean, basically we need hooks to know when the application started to get the logging going. We need hooks to know when images are closed or open, created. And sort of the creation flow in the GIMP is sort of wonky. I mean, knowing when an image is created and whether it's a user creating it or whether you're creating the thumbnail. So things like that are sort of convenient internally for the developers, but hooking into to distinguish between what is really a user, genuine user-generated event versus one that's in support of something else, like creating a thumbnail in the file open dialog box, can be a little tricky. But in general, it wasn't too bad. So if you want, we can talk offline about sort of, you know, what we had to do to get that in there. Yes?
The server is in Python?
The server is in Python. Yeah, which is great to develop in right now. If you go there, my biggest concern is really that the, so that page that's showing the dynamic statistics, this right here can get completely bogged down and just sit there for a while, and there's some things on the database server that are not optimized, and so it's really slow right now. But uploading the logs is just, you know, really quick. Processing is slow right now. At the end, so the log file is compressed onto the disk, and then when you close it, it's sent at one time. If you don't have a connection, it just sits there, so the next time you start up, it will send it. You could, it's just easier. You know, it's easier just to have it done at the end. That also gives us the flexibility of when it's actually transmitted, we have opportunity to talk back to the user. So I didn't mention this, but we have a kill switch in there so that if we want to, we can terminate the logging application. And we also can send back a dialog box to open up a URL. So if we have a questionnaire or something like that, we communicate with the user in that respect. So it's all sort of tied in again. It was just more convenient, basically, to do it all at once. Okay, well, thank you for your time. Thank you for going over.
So great. So I just want to let you know that to my